Hi, my name is Tina Sang, and we're starting the session called Health Services Research, Patient-Provider Interactions in Healthcare. I'm going to go ahead and introduce all the speakers and then let them go through their presentations, and we will hold questions for the end. So I'm just going to go ahead and go in sequence of all the speakers and give their bios. We'll start out with Dr. John McKinley, who is an internationally respected epidemiologist, health service researcher. He has led milestone HIV-supported epidemiologic projects in the fields of aging, minority, help-seeking behavior, endocrinology, urology, and diabetes. He pioneered the use of factorial experimentation in clinical decision-making research and has authored and co-authored over 500 publications, 18 books, including NIH Digital Anthology on Research Methods. Then we will have Dr. Lisa Welsh, who's the director of the Center for Qualitative Research at the New England Research Institutes. Dr. Welsh is a sociologist by training, and she applies her qualitative and mixed method expertise to a variety of health services research topics, including variation in providers' decision-making as a contributor to disparities in healthcare, patient illness experiences, and utilization of health services, and novel ways to disseminate health information. Then we have Dr. Johan Kling, sorry. he was a research fellow both at Hopkins and Harvard, and then he went on for his medical degree at Drostoff, and now he has started his academic career since 1999 as a professor of health sciences and public health at UT Dresden. He is the founding member of the German Society for Health Economics. He's published over 89 articles in scientific journals, 46 review and book chapters, and 25 edited books and special issues in journals. And last, we have Nikki Barefoot, is a fifth-year doctoral student in clinical psychology at Georgia Southern University in Statesboro, Georgia. She has a master's in clinical psychology and has worked as a clinician in a variety of settings, including rural and urban community mental health centers and an Army behavioral health clinic. She served as a research assistant as part of an interdisciplinary team of researchers at the Rural Health Research Institute, a NIH Center for Excellence at GSU, for 2 years investigating rural health disparities, and her primary research focus is rural LGBT mental and physical health disparities and barriers to care. Her dissertation project focuses on the disclosure experiences, barriers to care, and women's health risk factors for rural lesbians. She's currently a pre-doctoral intern at the Community Health Link Youth and Health and Family Services in Worcester, Massachusetts. Okay, I'll let Dr. McKinley take it away.
Thank you very much indeed. I bet you if anyone here goes home tonight and turns on the television, or to your hotel if you're visiting Boston, and you turn on the television, you will see an advertisement which says, ask your doctor, right? If you've got this, you've got that, ask your doctor. So what this talk is about is whether if you ask your doctor, the doctor is likely to give you what you ask for. So I want to report on two experiments that we conducted at the New England Research Institutes here in Massachusetts. So I have to tell you that there is no financial relationship with any commercial interest in the past 12 months. So if you think over the last few years, the way people have, pharmaceutical companies and other companies, device companies, have advertised, the traditional way, is direct to the physician. So most of this occurred advertising in professional medical journals. Another way that it occurred was using detail men, and they were usually men. And you saw these guys, I would say, lurking around hospital corridors trying to get doctors to adopt their products. The problem is that evidence suggests that only 1 in 4 doctors today regularly read a medical journal, so a lot of that advertising in journals is missed. And it takes a hell of a long time for doctors to adopt innovation. Some people say maybe 12 to 16 years. And nowadays, unlike the past, 80% of doctors are now salaried employees of organizations, and the organizations say, put up a barrier to detail men in pharmaceutical companies coming in and influencing them. And then, in addition, there has been, because of Senator Grassley's work in the Congress, there's been a spotlight on the cozy relationship that has existed between pharmaceutical companies and doctors. So things weren't looking so good. It took too long. People weren't taking reading journals. Detail men and women were banned from hospitals. There was a spotlight, and so the pharmaceutical industry, ever flexible in its approach, decided to change. So not so long ago, after about 1993, we had direct-to-consumer advertising. And this is where someone says, if you've got this, this, and this, and this is what you need, ask your doctor. It could be for Viagra, it could be for Celebrex, it could be for anything at all. So the pharmaceuticals decided to go over the heads of medical organization and physicians. This approach turns out to be extremely profitable. It's a $4 return for every $1 invested. So last year, about $5 billion was invested by the pharmaceuticals in direct-to-consumer advertising, which produced roughly $20 billion of sales, which is a great return. There are reports from Pew and other places that about 100 million people in the United States, a third of the population, go online for health information each year. About 65% of those people who go online go looking for a specific medical condition like arthritis or hypertension or diabetes, and 33%, a third, go online to check about a specific medication that they've been told about or have been advised to take. And there are studies which show that about 37% of patients, when they visit a doctor, talk about a specific medication they saw advertised. So what we are doing in this talk is we wanted to estimate how effective is a patient's medication request. We know it's going on, we know it's very popular today, but does it actually influence a doctor's prescribing behaviour? And secondly, we wanted to know, does it matter who makes the request? Whether it's a woman or an African American or an upper class person, or does it depend on characteristics of the doctor, their age, or their gender, or how many years they've been practicing. Now, this is what I'm reporting is not a survey, it's an experiment. So the only way to really disentangle all these complex factors, patient factors and physician factors, is to conduct a rigorous factorial experiment, which was what I'm going to report on today. It's very important to point out, for methodological reasons, we conducted two experiments, not one. So we did this experiment on 192 physicians who were primary care doctors, and with the interventions in the experiment were the use of videotapes of patients who presented certain signs and symptoms. And the signs and symptoms I'm going to tell you about in a minute, but half of the patients in the videos who had sciatica, which was one of the conditions, specifically requested oxycodone, an opioid. The other condition we had on the videotape was a patient presenting with osteoarthritis of the knee. Both conditions that are often seen by primary care doctors. A half of the patients in those videos asked for Celebrex, and half of them made no specific request at all. And so the sciatica patient had these. The pain in the sciatic distribution, radiating to the buttocks and legs, unilateral pain in one leg, neurogenic quality of the pain, described as knife-like, stabbing, sharp, burning, blah, 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 pain with coughing, so forth. Same with the osteoarthritis. The patient had aching, constant pain in the knee, much worse with weight bearing, improved when they sat down, no mechanical symptoms, no clicking or catching, increased functional limitations going upstairs, early morning pain, no response to certain drugs, and the patient had an occupation that involved motor vehicle operation, driving. So they were the scenarios. With these scenarios, we used professional actors and actresses to develop clinical scenarios from New York, and about 92% of the doctors who see these think that they're real cases. So there's a very high level of external validity, but the factorial experiment, of course, gives you a lot of internal validity. Now, so the patient with sciatica who was asking for medication said, my wife or husband had some oxycodone. This was done with clinical colleagues at the Brigham and Women's Hospital who were in primary care and in orthopedics. Left over from some dental surgery, and I took one last night, and I mean, it really worked. I was amazed, and I want some of that. That's all they said. The other one with osteoarthritis of the knee said, you know, I've seen ads for Celebrex. A woman I work with takes it, and it really works for her, so I would like some of that. That's all they said. All right? There's a case. These are just pictures to show you how we manipulated these variables in the experiment. So this was a working-class woman or bus driver versus a regional sales manager. And the guy at the bottom, Robert Tompkins, was 42 years of age. So we have here age, 60 or 40, black and white and female. But you'll see that, you know, there are all kinds of combinations. I wanted to give you this as an example. We got big differences by SES in this study, by the way, socioeconomic status. These are the same actors and actresses. You can see that. All we manipulated here is the guy, Robert Tompkins, on the right. He wore a suit and a tie. The guy on the left had a T-shirt. The woman at the top, all she had on here was a scarf and a brooch, and she had makeup. The one on the left didn't. That was all we did and mentioned their occupation. That was enough to produce incredibly different results. So, the results. So, this is the most important slide, and here it is here. So, for the patients who are asking for oxycodone, who presented with sciatica, just about 20% got it if they asked for it. The people who didn't ask for it was only 1%. This is highly significant at the 001 level. For the Celebrex, the patients who made an active request, over 50% got it. The ones who were passive and didn't make a request, it was what? Just over 20. So to summarise those results here, about 20% of the sciatica patients requesting oxycodone would receive the prescription for oxycodone, compared with 1% of them making no request. 53% of the patients with knee OA requesting Celebrex would receive it, compared to 24% of those making no request. So it had a big effect, right? But beyond that, sometimes they didn't prescribe oxycodone or Celebrex, but something else. So those who are prescribing something else, the important thing here is that not only did many of the doctors give the patient what they asked for, but if they didn't, they gave them a prescription in the class of medications that they were asking. So it's all, if you look down here on the right, nothing was really significant except the same strong narcotic or a non-selective NSAID. So the point here is that patients requesting oxycodone were more likely to receive a strong narcotic if they didn't get the oxycodone. So it triggered that class of drugs. Whereas those asking for Celebrex were more likely to receive a non-selective NSAID. Both significant, highly significant. So that's the second result. And then the third result, which is really the question, does it matter who the patient is, who's making the request? The women are more likely to get the doctor to accede than men, or older patients rather than younger patients, or patients who have higher social class may have more social capital and influence with the doctor compared to those who don't. When we looked at that, we find, if you look down on the right here, the p-values for both scenarios, there's nothing in it. It doesn't matter whether it was male or female, white, black, Hispanic, upper class, lower class. It doesn't matter whether the doctor was male or female. It doesn't matter how much experience they had. So the bottom line was that none of the patient characteristics and the ones we were able to look at in this experiment, which was a factorial, were gender, race, ethnicity, and the SES of the patient. And the physician characteristics we were able to have in the study were the gender of the doctor and the years of clinical experience, which is really a surrogate for age. So the bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is that patient requests for... Everyone knows that this is going on. Everyone knows that a lot of patients today are influenced by what they see on TV and what they read on the internet. But we're not sure, does it really make any a difference? You can ask, but do you receive? And we find in this rigorous factorial experiment that the patient requests for a specific medication significantly increases a physician's prescribing of that medication. The patient request drove the choice of prescriptions within the relevant class. So if they ask for narcotics, they're more likely to get stronger narcotics. If they ask for Celebrex, they're more likely to get non-selective NSAIDs. None of the patient characteristics or the physician characteristics made any difference in the study. And the importance of having two experiments, it permits replication. Two independent experiments, one of sciatica, one of osteoarthritis of the knee, and the important point, as you saw from the results are highly significant and consistent across both scenarios. And because we've replicated and we get the same results from two independent experiments, it adds to the robustness of the findings. Thank you very much. Do you want to have questions at the end or? Yeah.
I have a question.
Oh, go ahead.
Yes.
Great presentation.
Thank you. Yeah, because now that's a good question. This was not a survey where generalizability matters for the social survey. You want to get a representative sample. This, as I said at the beginning, was a factorial experiment. So you have cells, you stratify by various variables, and the point is that this is what we would call a purposive sample rather than a representative sample, because you have to recruit people to fill the cells to maintain the orthogonality required and the balance required by the factorial. The generalizability in these circumstances comes not from the representativeness of the sample, but the randomization of the videos. Sorry, yes, go ahead.
Yeah.
The patients who were lower SES, in that scenario, they were on public assistance, Medicare. So that was, whereas the upper class patients had private health insurance. So that's how we controlled for that. On the physician care, you know, there's one thing that one of my colleagues here has written on. We just put all these primary care physicians in one, this could be a limitation, in one big basket and recruited them. But we have got other studies which show that within primary care, there are very big differences in the management of patients between general internists and family doctors, even though in our research and health services, we lump them all together. So what we should probably do in the future is distinguish between the general internists who see things very biomedically, where, as against the family practitioners, who pay a lot more attention to psychosocial phenomena.